A long battle to control cabling began at this time. All the cables I have ever owned would stretch to the moon and back, except they would not be able to because they would fail to connect up with each other. Anyone can write a credible story in which humans can teleport, travel in time, and make themselves invisible. A future in which there are cable compatibility standards, that would be real science fiction. Cables, monitors, printers, books, magazines, discs, all these were costing me money. Money that I did not have. Richard Armitage had told me with an expansive wave of a cigar-brandishing hand that if ever I was running low, his assistant, Lorraine Hamilton, would send me checks to cover my expenses. These would count as advances against future earnings. Despite Kim's relative wealth and his easy generosity, I had run up a debt of several £1,000s with Richard by the August of 1982 and was beginning to worry that I would never earn enough to be able to pay him back. Commercial. One morning, Lorraine called me up at the Chelsea flat. I know it was at the Chelsea flat, because in those days when you rang someone, you always knew where they were. The closest life came to a mobile phone was a handset with an extra long flex. Lorraine told me to go to an office in Fitzrovia and meet a man called Paul Wayland, who was casting a beer commercial. Beer commercial? Me? A low, vulgar commercial for a highly polished artist such as myself? How unbelievably insulting. I almost ran to the appointed place. The golden age of British advertising was just coming to an end. The most prominent stars to have risen over the past decade had been Ridley and Tony Scott, Hugh Hudson, David Putnam and Alan Parker, who now all devoted their time to feature films. Paul Wayland, a generation behind, had started his career as a T-boy at the production office where most of those big names had worked and was to become the leading commercials director of the 80s and 90s. Indeed, he still reigns supreme. He handed me a script that was really more of a photocopied storyboard. It showed a monocled Victorian aristocrat in a series of unlikely poses. "There's no dialogue," Paul said. "The whole commercial is played out to a soundtrack. The song Abdul, a Bulbul Amir. Do you know it?" I had to confess that I did not. "Never mind. Take this mug. You're drinking the beer. It's Whitbread Best Bitter. You're Count Ivan Skavinsky Skavar, and I'm Abdul. Just give me a really snooty look. Snootier, as if he's a caterpillar in your salad or shit on your shoe." For 10 minutes I pretended to drink Whitbread snootily while a most peculiar song played in the background. I'm not sure I've ever been more embarrassed and uncomfortable or felt more ill at ease, self-conscious and incompetent. When it was all over, I left, blushing furiously. "Well, Stephen," I said to myself, "that is the last you will ever hear of that. Perhaps it is as well. Perhaps I was so bad because my innermost soul was revolting at the mercenary grubbiness of the whole enterprise. Yes, that will be it." The next day, Lorraine called me up and asked me to come into the Noel Gay offices in Denmark Street. Richard was sitting behind his enormous desk, beaming behind a thick curtain of villager cigar smoke.
They want you for the Whitbread commercial," he said, "but I'm afraid they're being irritatingly tough on the money."
Oh, well, I thought, £500 or £600 would come in useful. It would be as much as that, surely.
"They offered 20, said Richard, "and I can't seem to get them above 25. If you find that insulting, we can always walk away."
"For how many hours' work?"
Richard looked down at his notes. 3 days.
"Blimey," I said, trying not to look too disappointed. "It isn't much."
No, said Richard. "It's just over 8,000 a day. Well, if you feel..."
"Thousand?" I swallowed dryly, pushing my Adam's apple past a throbbing constriction that was rising in my throat and threatening to cause me to choke. £25,000 for 3 days' work?
No, I faltered. No, it's fine. They speak very highly of Paul Wayland. Good experience for you. Start shooting in Shepparton on Monday. They'll want you at Berman's and Nathan's for a costume fitting tomorrow at 3. Excellent. I'll call the agency.
I tottered about London for the rest of that morning, in a dream. I could pay back Noel Gay artists everything I owed them, and I would still be rich, rich beyond the dreams of avarice. Well, not that, obviously. The dreams of avarice go well beyond 25,000-odd pounds, minus 15% commission, minus tax and VAT, minus 3,500 already owing, but rich enough for me. You would have just cause to hate me now, listener, when I tell you that from that day to this, I have never had what one could seriously call money troubles. Not money troubles of the kind that cause so many people to wake up in the middle of the night with a ghastly feeling like molten lead leaking into their stomach as they contemplate mounting debt and the apparent impossibility of getting their finances in order. That tremble of panic and dread that so many feel in relation to money, I have been spared. I feel it for other things, but I know that many in the world would trade much for the kind of cushion of cash that has enveloped me for 30 years. I did not know, as I went about London window shopping that day, that in 2.5 years' time even more money would start pouring in. The 3 days of the shoot in Shepperton Studios passed in a sweat of worry, embarrassment and confusion. I had no idea why everything took so long, what I was doing, who everyone was, or what the commercial was about. Tim McInerney, whom I was to get to know 2 years later when I joined the cast of Blackadder 2, had been cast as a lute-wielding minstrel of some kind. The character of Abdul was played by an actor called Tony Cosmo, who was suitably swarthy and menacing. I, in my own estimation, failed to be suitably anything. Watching it today on YouTube, try searching for Whitbread Best Bitter 1982 ad or similar, the film still appears to make very little sense, and I'm sure that even now my discomfort in the role of Count Ivan transmits across the decades. I think I was cast on account of my pointy chin rather than because of any discernible skill or talent. Paul Weyland was charming and easygoing. My memories of the exceptionally laid-back Hugh Hudson on the set of Chariots of Fire had prepared me to expect relaxation from the director and fiery shouting only from assistants, and this was exactly how it was. I spent most of the 3 days sitting in a canvas chair and drinking cups of tea while birds twittered and shitted in the gantry far above. There are generations of pigeon, sparrow and chaffinch that have lived out their lives in the roof spaces of the great sound stages of Pinewood and Shepperton. They have dumped their droppings on some of the immortal scenes of British cinema, and their screechings have interrupted dialogue from Dirk Bogarde, John Mills, Kenneth Williams, Roger Moore and 1,000 others. Mostly, however, they have overseen the less glamorous business of commercial and pop video shoots that make up the bread-and-butter business for studio staff, film crews, and happily overpaid actors. I know that I'm supposed to be ashamed of advertising work and feel that it is either beneath me or some kind of sellout, but I cannot bring myself to apologise or regret. Orson Welles always said with high-handed disdain, "If it was good enough for Toulouse-Lautrec and John Everett Millais, then it is good enough for me." But I don't really feel the need to adduce the names of great figures from the past. I just find it fun. Create. We were back in Manchester by October, filming for Alfresco, which, unlike There's Nothing to Worry About, was to be broadcast nationally. Ben had created for us a fictional world that he called the Pretend Pub. The concept might kindly be described as playful metatextual postmodernism. Most people, however, were not kind and seemed to regard it as incomprehensible self-indulgent twaddle, which I suppose is how most playful metatextual postmodernism is received. We all portrayed heightened versions of ourselves in an obviously unreal studio pub. I was Stezza, Hugh was Huzza, Robbie Bobzer, Ben Bezzer, Emma Ezzer, and Siobhan Shizzer. We still often call each other by those names to this day, although Ben, for reasons lost in time, usually calls me Bing. In the first episode, I enter, covered in polystyrene flakes of stage snow, greeting Robbie with the words, "My word, pretend landlord Bobzer, there's a hell of a theatrical effect going on out there." We performed these sketches in front of a mostly silent and bemused audience. We consoled ourselves with the thought that we were ahead of our time. I think a great deal of the problem came from self-consciousness. Ben knew very well, partly because he was directly involved, what his contemporaries were doing in the field of alternative comedy, and Hugh and I were painfully and acutely aware of what our tradition had done in the field of sketch comedy, from Pete and Dud through to Python and Not the 9 o'clock News. As a result, we were guilty, it is clear looking back, of overcomplicating everything out of a fear of being perceived as imitative and unoriginal. We ruled out parodies and come in, Perkins, shut the door, do sit down sketches, because Python and Knot had done these. Surreality and anarchic weirdness were out too, because Rick, Aid and Alexi had cornered that market. So we wallowed about sightlessly, guiltily and confusedly, without the confidence to do what we did best. Audiences, I now realise, and frankly it should always have been blindingly obvious, do not think along such lines. Novelty and originality do not come from the invention of new milieus, new genres or new modalities. They come from the how and the who, not from the what. It hardly warrants pointing out, furthermore, that no one will get anywhere unless they do what they do best, and everyone in their secret, secret heart knows what they do best. Meanwhile, Steve Morrison, our Scottish executive producer, pleaded with us to stop bellyaching. "Go out and create, man!" he yelled at me across a table one stormy afternoon when I was behaving more than usually pedantically or sceptically or in some other manner guaranteed to annoy. He stood and pointed at the door. "I want Akeborn with Edge!" he screamed. "Go out and bring me Akeborn with Edge!" Well, quite. It was made obvious to us that high up in Granada, a problem with our writing had been identified. In the case of Ben, it might have been overproductivity and a lack of self-censorship. In the case of Hugh and me, it was exactly the opposite, crippling constipation and a kind of apologetic, high-toned embarrassment that must have been excessively irritating. For one excruciating week, we all had to undergo a kind of comedy writing masterclass with Bernie Sarlins, one of the producers of the Second City Review Group and television show. Bernie, brother of the anthropologist Marshall Sarlins, was from a tradition of improvisation that he helped create back in the days of Mike Nichols and Elaine May, a tradition that had burst into television and more recently film with the Saturday Night Live generation of Aykroyd, Chase, Murray, Belushi and Radner. Ben wrote alone and wasn't faintly interested in the styles and techniques of Chicago improv. Hugh and I were pretty appalled, too, at the idea of building a scene through improvisational dialogue in the approved American way. When we wrote together, we sometimes did improvise, inasmuch as we made a sketch up out loud as we went along before committing it to paper. I suppose that if we had been accused of improvising, we would have frozen in horror midway and would never have been able to continue. The cultural gulf between our way and Bernie Sullins's way must have perplexed and even offended him, but it was an unbridgeable one, and he left Manchester after 5 days without having made a dent in us. He did teach us that if we'd been born American, we would never, ever have made it in the comedy business, and we perhaps taught him that the British people are stubborn, shy, and entirely dominated by their single predominant emotion, affect, vice, characteristic, disease, whatever one might call it. Embarrassment. Ben carried on pouring out script after script in his way, and we carried on not pouring out anything much in ours. As well as Steve Morrison, Sandy Ross, Robbie and Siobhan, we now had a fifth Scot on board in the shape of a producer called John G. Temple. Hugh revealed that Temple had approached him early one morning as we'd been getting into costumes for a day's filming and asked him what drugs I was on. "No drugs," Hugh had said. "That's just how Stephen is." When he relayed this exchange to me, I'd been profoundly shocked. What was it about me that could possibly lead a stranger to leap to the instant conclusion that I must be on drugs? Hugh explained to me with as much tact as he could manage that it was possibly my excessive energy in the mornings. I had always been loud and verbally exuberant from the earliest hours, but it had never occurred to me that this mania might be extreme enough to present the appearance of drug abuse. Everyone else was used to my often exaggerated elation and bounce, but they were evidently weird enough to a newcomer like John to excite the wildest speculation. Perhaps this should have sounded as a warning in my head for me to attend to my states of mind a little more carefully, but when one is young, eccentricities, moods and behavioural tics are easily overlooked, ignored or laughingly dealt with. One is so much more supple. One can bend with all the gnarls and twists and kinks that life and the caprices of one's mind confer. Past 40, it is, of course, another story. What once was whippy and pliable now snaps like dried bone. So much that is charming, unusual, provocative, and admirably strange in youth becomes tragic, lonely, pathological, boring, and ruinous in middle age. A hurt or troubled mind plays out a story very like that of an alcoholic's life. A 20-year-old who drinks heavily is a bit of a rogue. Sometimes he may be a little flushed in the face, sometimes too pie-eyed to turn up to this or that appointment on time, but usually he, or she, of course, will be lovable enough and resilient enough to get on with life. Quite when the broken veins, spongy nose, humourless bloodshot eyes, and hideous personality changes take full root, it is hard to say, but one day everyone notices that their hard-drinking friend is no longer funny and no longer charming. They've become an embarrassment, a liability, and a bore. I have seen and experienced the same with little personality wrinkles and dispositions that have been so acceptable and endearing and apparently harmless in youth, yet have proved destructive to the point of agony, addiction, degeneration, misery, self-harm, and suicide in later years. There have been moments in writing this book when I have looked back at nearly all my friends and contemporaries, myself included, of course, so many of them blessed with talent, brains, brilliance, and good fortune, and I have found myself forced to believe that all of us have failed in life, or life has failed us. In our 50s, the physical deterioration which one would naturally expect has been far outstripped by disappointment, bitterness, despair, mental instability, and failure. Then I slap myself across the chops and tell myself not to be so hysterical and self-dramatizing. And yet the episode with the car might be regarded by some doctors as a typical episode of hypomanic grandiosity. Car. The sixth Scot in the Alfresco lineup was Dave McNiven, our resident musical director and composer. Naturally, I saw very little of him. Once his sensitive ear had heard me miming, our professional paths were set never to cross again. You may wonder how he can have heard me miming, but this just shows the depths of unmusicality to which I was capable of sinking. It is very hard to be in a chorus and to mime without one's vocal cords just occasionally making themselves heard. A musical ear can pick up a discord instantly, no matter how many voices are singing and no matter how low and inadvertent the tiny sound that emanates. I shall never forget the shocked look on Dave's face as he spun round in my direction. I'd seen it before, and I was destined to see it many times again. It was the particular look of dismay that registers on the countenance of one who only moments before has said with supreme certainty and unruffled confidence, "Oh, believe me, everyone can sing." I exist on this planet precisely to teach such wrong-headed optimists the error of their convictions. The afternoons given over to musical rehearsals, therefore, I filled with more driving lessons. I had taken a few while teaching at Cundall Manor. Back then, as I had bucked and jerked the motoring school's Austin Metro down the main street of Thirsk, I had been told, with hard Yorkshire disdain, "The gear and clutch control is shite, and the steering is as much use as a chocolate teapot." The Mancunian instructor, 4 years later, was much friendlier, as people so often are west of the Pennines, or perhaps it was that my car-handling skills had improved in the interval. He would hum quietly to himself and look interestedly out of the window at the street scenes that flashed by, apparently confident enough in my driving not to bother about what I was doing, as I manoeuvred the dual-control Escort along his favourite route, past the university halls of residence in Rusholme and Fallowfield, down Kingsway and into the maze of residential back streets around Cheadle Hume. One afternoon, quite unexpectedly, he announced that I was ready to take my test, and that he had booked me in for the following week. "If you've no objection." Half an hour later, I found myself in a BMW showroom, shaking hands on a deal. I have no idea what rush of blood to the head had propelled me there, but by the time I left it was too late to do anything about it. I'd called up my bank and arranged the financing, and was now the legal owner of a second-hand 323i in metallic green, sunroof, Blaupunkt stereo, and 16,000 miles on the clock. That evening, not having dared tell Hugh that I'd done something so magisterially arsy and recklessly tempting of Providence as to buy a car before I had even passed my driving test, we all gathered in my room at the Midland Hotel. I ordered up wine, beer and crisps, and we watched a repeat of May's original transmission of our Footlights show. 2 days later, we assembled again with even more wine, beer and crisps to watch the launch of the all-new Channel 4, which included in its opening night lineup Comic Strip Presents Five Go Mad in Dorset, in which Robbie played two parts. This was the first new channel on British television since the arrival of BBC Two in 1964. I passed my driving test, raced around insurance offices, and returned to the car showroom properly possessed of paperwork that allowed me to drive away. I had teased and flirted with destiny and got away with it. If I had failed my test, I wonder what I would have done with the car. Simply left it there, I suppose. Challenge 2. A week later, we met for a third time in my hotel room, and surrounded by all the wine, beer and crisps the Midland staff could produce, we watched the first episode of The Young Ones, which Ben had co-written and in which he also appeared. Within a week, then, two seismic events had rocked our little world. The gleaming, primary-coloured blocks that had flown out to form the graphic figure 4, which made up the channel's logo, seemed, with their smooth, computer-generated motion, to usher in a brave new world. And when Aid Edmondson as Vivian punched his way through the kitchen wall in the opening 5 minutes of The Young Ones, it felt as though a whole new generation had punched its way into British cultural life and that nothing would ever be the same again. The Young Ones was an instant success in exactly the way Alfresco, whose first series wasn't broadcast until mid-1983, manifestly wasn't. Rick Mayall, especially, soared into stardom as the new king of comedy. The brilliantly childish, Cliff Richard-obsessed character of Rick in The Young Ones, with his exaggerated deroticizations and uncontrolled giggling snorts, sealed a reputation that had grown from Rick's original 20th Century Coyote act with Aid Edmondson and his sublime appearances in A Kick Up the 80s as Kevin Turvey, the Chick Murray of Kidderminster. The wild divergence I felt between this hot lava stream of new talent and the constipated, conventional and constricted tradition from which I derived was extreme and has, I'm sure you will feel, been dwelt on enough. From the distance of 30 years, it seems self-indulgent and paranoid to harp on about it, but the distinction did at least lead to one fruitful conversation in the bar of the Midland in January 1983. Ben, Rick and Lisa had already started work on a second series of The Young Ones, and the thought had struck me, having spent so much time in Granada land and having watched lines of undergraduates queuing up, as I had 3 years earlier, for canteen lunches in between rounds of University Challenge, that perhaps Rick, Vivian, Neil and Mike, being a student foursome, might themselves be entered for the quiz with, as the Radio Times might phrase it, hilarious consequences. I suggested this to Ben, who instantly enthused. He and the others produced Bambi, in which the Young Ones, representing Scumbag University, came up against Footlights College, Oxbridge, in the snooty privileged persons of Hugh, Emma, Ben and me. My character was called Lord Snot, an insanely shiny toff based on the Beano's Lord Snooty. Ben may well have a different memory of the genesis of that episode. It is one of the known eternal truths of comic creation that a good idea has a dozen parents, while a duff one remains an orphan. From wherever or whomever this idea derived, the show was recorded a year or so later with Griff Rhys-Jones as Bambi Gascoigne and Mel Smith as a Granada TV security guard. It is still considered, I think, one of the most memorable of the Young Ones episodes, in part because of an unusually strong and coherent narrative, and in part also because the parricidal revenge of the new and radical upon the old and reactionary is played out so literally and satisfyingly. Footlights College are routed and humiliated as completely in fiction as we felt we were being in fact. I've mentioned that we were all, Hugh and I to a crippling extent, hobbled by self-consciousness and a foolish desire to avoid what we considered had been done before. But did we have any kind of a theory of comedy, any banner that we wanted to raise? It was clear to me that Hugh had a more complete canteen of comic cutlery in his drawer than the pitiful selection of plastic coffee stirrers and archaic horn-handled knives that I felt capable of wielding. As I have said, I was aware, without envy but with a measure of sorrow and self-pity, that Hugh was a master of three enormously important elements of comedy in which I was an embarrassing incompetent. He had music. He could play any instrument that he picked up, and he could sing. He had physical control of his body. As a natural athlete, he could roll, fall, leap, dance and jig to comic effect. He had an amusing, appealing face that made him a natural clown. Big, sad eyes, a funny chin, and a hilarious upper lip. And I? Well, I could be verbally adept and I could play pompous authority figures and, that was it, really. Could I cut it as an actor, or had my commitment to comedy cut that avenue off? In the comic world, I had no social or political axe to grind, no new stylistic mode to advance. I liked the old-fashioned sketch comedy, for which it was beginning to look as though the world had little time. I worried that I was going to have to be primarily a writer. Why worry, you might ask? Well, although it is true that one feels fantastic when one has finished a writing task, it is mostly horrible while one is doing it. You will see, therefore, that writing, ghastly at the time, but great afterwards, is exactly the opposite of sex. All that keeps one going is the knowledge that one will feel good when it's all over. I knew, as all writers know, that performers have a much easier life. They swan about being admired, recognised, pampered, praised, and told how wonderful they are, and what energy and resource and strength they have to cope with all that pressure. Pah! They only work while they are in rehearsal, on set or on stage. For the rest of the time, they can get up late and laze and lounge about like lords. Writers, on the other hand, are in a permanent state of school exam crisis. Deadlines croak and beat their wings above them like sinister rooks. Producers, publishers and performers nag for rewrites and improvements. Any downtime looks like evasion and indolence. There is no moment at which one cannot and should not, it seems, be at one's desk. It is also a desperately lonely calling. There are compensations. You only have to write a play once, and then you can sit back and let the money roll in, while the actors have to perform it 8 times a week for 6 months to earn their pay packets. Hugh and I were writer-performers. We wrote the material that we performed. I could not decide whether this meant we had the best of both worlds or the worst. To this day, I cannot be sure. It is obvious, however, that in terms of employment, it doubles one's opportunities. Whatever I lacked in physical attributes as a natural clown, I seemed to make up for in gravitas, to use Hugh's word. It seemed that people did have faith in my ability to write, although I had produced nothing up until that point except Latin, and with Hugh the material in the sellotapes and the handful of alfresco sketches that had made it through to transmission. 4 things now happened in a succession rapid enough to be called simultaneity, and which served to bolster the self-esteem that the alfresco experience was doing so much to undermine. Cinema. In the late summer of 1982, I was sent to meet a woman called Jilly Gutteridge and a man called Don Boyd. Boyd had produced Alan Clark's cinema version of Scum. The original 1977 BBC television production had been Mary Whitehouse off the screen, as well as Derek Jarman's Tempest and Julian Temple's The Great Rock and Roll Swindle. And he now planned to direct his first major feature film, which was to be called Gossip. He imagined a British compendium of the sweet smell of success and La Dolce Vita, infused with the spirit and manner of Evelyn Waugh's Vile Bodies. This was to be a film that would capture a new and horrible side to Thatcher's Britain, the recently confident, arrogant, vulgar, slony world in which nightclub narcissists, trust fund trash, and Philistine druggy aristos cavorted with recently cherished icons of finance, fashion, and celebrity. It was a soulless, squalid, valueless, and trashy milieu that believed itself to be the stylish social summit at whose dazzling peaks the lower world gazed with breathless envy and admiration. A script had been written by the brothers Michael and Stephen Tolkien. Although their screenplay had been set in Britain, Don felt that as Americans they had not quite captured the world of London society, such as it was in the early 80s, and he was after someone who could rewrite it in an authentic English voice. Jilly Gutteridge, who was to be location manager and assistant producer, was instantly affectionate and charmingly enthusiastic about my talents, and I walked away from the meeting having been given the job of rewriting the script for the princely sum of £1,000. I had 3 weeks in which to do it. The part of the lead character, a Beaumont gossip columnist, was to be played by Anne-Louise Lambert. Anthony Higgins, who had starred opposite her in Peter Greenaway's The Draftsman's Contract, would be the man with whom she falls in love and who would rescue her from the unworthy world she inhabits. Simon Callow and Gary Oldman were also cast. It was to be Oldman's first film appearance. I rewrote in a fever of excitement. and Don seemed pleased with my efforts. His preparations were well advanced for what I soon learnt was known as the principal photography. In the meanwhile, he suggested I might enjoy a meeting with Michael Tolkien, who just happened to be in town. As one of the original writers, he had read my anglicising rewrites with great interest and might even have one or two valuable suggestions. I assented to this idea, and Tolkien and I met in an Italian restaurant called the Villa Puccini, which was just yards from the Draycott Place flat. "The Villa Puccini," said Kim, "named, one must suppose, after the famous composer Villa-Lobos." The lunch was not destined to be the feast of reason and the flow of soul, of which P.G. Wodehouse and Alexander Pope wrote so fondly. Tolkien was very disapproving of what I had done to his beloved story. He was outraged at my excision of a synagogue scene. The focal point of the narrative, the pivot about which the entire movie revolves, the centerpiece, the keystone, the emotional heart. The whole picture is meaningless without that scene. There is no picture without it. You couldn't see that? I tried as best I could to explain why I had felt it was wrong and unconvincing. And as for your ending, I suspect he may have been right about my ending. As far as I recall, I had Claire, the heroine, escape into the arms of a Cambridge don, which was neither very Fellini nor very Evelyn Waugh, and in its own way was probably as sentimental as the synagogue scene. Nonetheless, I attempted to defend it. "It is obvious," said Tolkien, "that we have nothing in common and no basis for further discussion." He left the restaurant before the Prima Piatti arrived. He has since made a highly successful writing career with credits that include The Player, Deep Impact and Nine. Maybe he was right. Maybe I had ruined gossip with my cynical British resistance to the possibilities of emotional change and with my inept ending. In any event, the film never got made. The story of its disaster is complicated, but I'm happy to say has nothing to do with my screenplay, good or bad as that may have been. It seems that Don Boyd had been hoodwinked by two plausible characters who claimed to represent something they called the Martini Foundation. Rich with funds accrued from the sale of the vermouth business, this foundation wanted to branch out into film financing. The two promised that $20 million would be made available to Don for a whole slate of feature films. In the meantime, he could finance gossip by raising money against certificates of deposit that were lodged in a bank in the Netherlands. For their investment, the Martini people would receive 50% of the profits and a £600,000 upfront fee. Don set to work on the construction of a huge Andrew McAlpine-designed nightclub set in Twickenham Studios, and filming began sometime in late October, using money that had been advanced by a third party against the arrival of these certificates of deposit. Hugh Laurie, John Sessions and others had also been cast, and about a fifth of the whole movie had been committed to celluloid by the time the terrible truth emerged that there were no certificates of deposit. That those two plausible figures with their Mayfair flat and Cannes yacht had no connection with Martini Rosso or its money, and that Don had been ruthlessly swindled. They imagined, one supposes, that they would get their £600,000 finder's fee and skedaddle. Fortunately, the whole house of cards collapsed before they could profit from their deception, but it was small consolation. The film collapsed. The technical unions and the acting union Equity demanded blood. Many of the crew and cast salaries and many of the production costs had not yet been met. The Tolkiens and I had been scrupulously paid, as it happens, and all was ruin, recrimination and wrath. The upshot was that poor Don, one of the kindest and best of men, was effectively blacklisted and prevented from participating in film production for 3 years. Even that didn't end it, for once Don managed to start up again, the unions insisted he continue to pay over what negligible producing fees he did earn. By 1992, he was financially wiped out. If he had declared himself bankrupt the moment disaster had struck, he might have saved his house and possessions. In fact, he sold most of what he had to repay debts, because he believed that to be the honourable course. Don Boyd was ill-treated, cold-shouldered and bad-mouthed by many in the British film industry, who blamed him for being either foolishly naive or, worse, being somehow implicated in the smoky business of the fraudulent Martini Foundation. Many wiser and better heads than his had advised him that the financing deal was sound and that he was right to proceed. It was a catastrophic error to go into production without a sight of these certificates of deposit, but so talented, idealistic, and passionately committed a filmmaker did not deserve the opprobrium and pariah status he was accorded for so many years. It was certainly a hell of a way for me to be dunked, a year after leaving university, into the murky waters of the film business. Church and Chekhov. A few months after the gossip imbroglio, a theatrical producer called Richard Jackson called me up and invited me to his offices in Knightsbridge. He had seen Latin in Edinburgh and had a desire to produce it at the Lyric Theatre, Hammersmith, with the very young Nicholas Broadhurst directing. I made it clear that my commitments to Alfresco meant that I would be unable to play the role of Dominic, the part I had written for myself, but this did not seem to put Jackson off. I was immensely gratified by this. You might think my actor's self-esteem might be dented to hear a producer take so blithely the news that I was not available, but actually my writer's self-esteem was immensely boosted by the idea that a professional man of the theatre believed the play to be strong enough to merit a life without me. Many months earlier, I had had a conversation with a television director called Geoffrey Sachs, who was keen to make a small-screen version of Latin. I underwent the nervous excitement of a phone conversation with the great Michael Horden, who had expressed an interest in the part of Herbert Brookshaw, and who listened kindly and calmly to my incoherent plans for the adaptation. Nothing came of this, although I was to see Geoffrey Sachs 8 years later, when he directed an episode of The New Statesman, in which I made a guest appearance, and again almost 20 years after that, when he directed me in a small role in the film Stormbreaker. Few people in one's life ever go quite away. They turn up again like characters in a Simon Raven novel. It is as if fate is a movie producer who cannot afford to keep introducing new characters into the script, but must get as many scenes out of every actor as possible. Nicholas and Richard were confident that they could mount Latin with ease, but the role of Dominic turned out to be more difficult to cast than they had anticipated. While I was up at Manchester for Alfresco's Series 2, they auditioned dozens and dozens of young actors, none of whom they felt to be quite right. At a meeting in Richard's office, I nervously made a suggestion. "Look, I know how pathetic this sounds, but there's someone I was at university with. He's a really good actor and very funny." "Oh, yes." Richard and Nicholas were polite, but there are few phrases more certain to send a chill down the spine of a producer than, "There's this friend of mine, he's awfully good." I carried on. "He's left Cambridge now, and he's at the Guildhall School. Actually, he enrolled at the music school to be an opera singer, but I heard he's just switched over to the drama department." "Oh, yes." "Well, as I say, I know it's... But he really is very good." "Oh, yes." A week later, Richard called up. "I have to confess, we're at our wits' end. What was the name of this friend of yours at RADA?" "The Guildhall, not RADA, and he's called Simon Beale." "Well, I won't deny it, we're desperate. Nicholas will see him." 2 days later, Nicholas called up ecstatically. "My God, he's brilliant, perfect, absolutely perfect." I knew he would be. Ever since I'd shared a stage with his arse-scratching Sir Politic would-be in Volpone, I had known Simon was the real thing. A snag was foreseen. Would the Guildhall actually let him play the part? He was a student following a specific course, and aside from the performances, which cut enough into his day, this was to be a lunchtime performance at the Lyric, there were the rehearsals to be considered too. Newly appointed as director of the Guildhall School of Music and Drama was the actor and founder member of the Royal Shakespeare Company, Tony Church, and his permission to release Simon was sought. The answer he gave was magnificent in its preciosity and absurd actorly self-importance. "I can see that this is an engagement that Simon is keen to accept," he said. "It is an excellent role for him, and aside from anything else, it guarantees his provisional equity ticket." In those days, the acquisition of an equity card was absolutely essential for any actor. The world of drama presented that exquisitely cruel catch-22 bind common to all closed shops. Only equity members could get an acting job, and you could not become an equity member unless you had an acting job. Hugh and I had secured our cards because we had a Granada TV contract, and because as writer-performers we could show that no existing equity member would be able satisfactorily to take our places. Tony Church was recognising, therefore, the excellence of the opportunity that Simon Beale was being offered. "Yes," he said, "I will not stand in his way. However..." Nicholas and Richard, I was not present, blanched nervously. However, continued Church, for the period that he will be away rehearsing and performing, he will exactly miss out on the 3 weeks in which we will be covering Chekhovian characterization and performance. So I am duty bound to warn Simon that if he goes ahead with this play, it will leave one heck of a hole in his Chekhov technique. He was a fine man, Tony Church, and one endowed with an excellent sense of humour, so it is to be hoped he would not have minded my repeating this. The idea that any actor would somehow be left deficient by missing out on 3 weeks of drama school Chekhov teaching is so preposterous, so frankly insane, that one simply does not know where to begin. If ever I am asked by aspiring young actors or their parents whether or not they should go to drama school, the memory of Tony Church and his fear for Simon's Chekhov technique almost makes me tell them on no account to go anywhere near such useless palaces of self-regarding folly and delusion. Of course, I do not offer any advice at all, other than suggesting that budding actors should follow their hearts and other such sententious and harmless ullage. But one does wonder, one really does. Simon Beale, under his equity name of Simon Russell Beale, has become almost universally recognised as the finest stage actor of his generation. For many, the greatest of his theatrical achievements have been his interpretations of, yes, of course, characters in the plays of Chekhov. His stunning performances in The Seagull at the RSC, Uncle Vanya at the Donmar Warehouse, for which he won an Olivier Award, and The Cherry Orchard at the Old Vic and in New York, have earned unanimous praise. I wonder if any of his Guildhall contemporaries, the ones lucky enough to have stayed in school for those vital lessons in technique, have enjoyed comparable success with Chekhov. The production of Latin was, in its own small way, accounted a success. Simon was brilliant, and a glowing review from the great Harold Hobson made me very happy indeed. Cockney Capers. The weekend after Latin completed its little run, I stayed at Richard Armitage's house in Essex. The house was called Stebbing Park, and it was a fine old mansion set in many acres of gently rolling countryside. The village of Stebbing is close to Dunmow, in an area of Essex that belies the county's unfortunate and unjustified reputation. Stebbing Park came into its own every summer when Richard held a festival of cricket. David Frost, one of his first clients, would keep wicket. Russell Harty would lie on the boundary ropes and admire the thews of Michael Praed and other handsome young actors. Andrew Lloyd Webber would arrive by helicopter. The controllers of BBC One and BBC Two would cluster in corners with Bill Cotton and the Director General. It seemed as if Richard could attract every important figure from British screen and stage. Rowan Atkinson, Emma Thompson, Hugh, Tony Slattery, Tilda Swinton, Howard Goodall and I came every year, as did dozens of other Noel Gay clients. Richard Stilgo, Chris Barry, Hingen, Brackett, Dollar, the Cambridge Buskers, Jan Leeming, Manuel and the Music of the Mountains, the King Singers, Jeff Love. It was a most eccentric mixture. On this occasion, however, it was just me, Richard, and Lorraine Hamilton, the sweet, shy young woman with whom he shared his life and who worked as his assistant. We had Richard's chef butler, Ken, all to ourselves. After an excellent dinner on Friday night, as Ken poured coffee in the drawing room, Richard, greatly to my surprise, started to talk about his father. Reginald Armitage was the son of a pomfret cake manufacturer in South Yorkshire. He had been educated at the Queen Elizabeth Grammar School in Wakefield, the Royal College of Music, and Christ's College, Cambridge. His musicianship won him the place at an early age as music director and organist at St. Anne's Church, Soho. The ragtime, jazz and swing that permeated that part of London must have got into Reginald's blood, for he soon found he had an extraordinary facility with light, bouncy, catchy tunes in the modern manner. To avoid upsetting his worthy Yorkshire parents and the church authorities who employed him, he composed his songs under the pseudonym Noel Gay. An unfortunate name to our ears, but in the late 20s and 30s it suggested that happy, merry world of bright sunbursts that one sees in the surviving suburban front door frames and wireless set designs of the period. If there is a song that expresses that image perfectly, it is his own The Sun Has Got His Hat On. Noel Gay, the composer, became a gigantic success. At one point, he had four musicals running in the West End simultaneously, a feat only Andrew Lloyd Webber has matched. His most famous tune, The Lambeth Walk, remains the only song ever written about in a Times Leader. It also, Richard told me, earned Noel Gay an entry in the legendary Black Book of Names of those who would be first up against the wall in the event of a Nazi invasion. Hitler did not take kindly, it was said, to a piece of newsreel that was very popular in British wartime cinemas, which looped footage of the Führer saluting a goose-stepping cadre of stormtroopers to the sound of The Lambeth Walk. I had known very little of this and was touched that Richard thought I would be interested in the exploits of his famous father. "Of course, his greatest success," said Richard, "was the musical in which The Lambeth Walk featured, Me and My Girl." "Right," I said, thinking in a rather puzzled way of the Gene Kelly, Judy Garland standard, "The Bells Are Ringing for Me and My Gal." Surely that was an American song. "Not to be confused, of course," said Richard, "with the Edgar Leslie number, For Me and My Gal." "No, indeed, of course not," I said, shocked at the idea that anyone might do such a thing. "Me and My Girl," said Richard, "was the most successful British musical of its day. It has only just been overtaken by Cats." Richard had one of those endearing habits, very common to agents, producers, and magnates generally, of describing everything and everyone he knew as being more or less the most important, successful, and respected example of its kind anywhere ever. Certainly the most significant choreographer of his generation. The top wine merchant in Britain. Indisputably the most admired chef in all Asia, that sort of thing. It is especially impossible for people like Richard not to have the best doctor in London, the finest dentist in Europe, and favourite of all and endlessly trotted out whenever someone betrays the slightest dorsal twinge, the best back man in the world. I was already wise to this trait in Richard, so could not be quite sure how much of what he said about Me and My Girl was true, and how much a mixture of this signature hyperbole and understandable filial pride. For in truth, I had not heard of the musical, nor its title song. I knew The Lambeth Walk. Naturally, it is one of the most famous tunes ever, an Ohrwurm, as they say in Germany, an earworm that once heard burrows its way into your brain and becomes impossible to dislodge. Actually, I had always thought it a folk song based on some ancient tune that had been handed down through the generations. It certainly never occurred to me that it might have been composed in the 1930s by a church organist. Noel Gay had sent his son Richard to Eton, from where he had followed his father's progress to Cambridge. In 1950, the young Richard Armitage founded Noel Gay Artists, a talent agency that was designed to enhance his father's, Noel Gay's, song publishing and production business by supplying singers to perform Noel Gay material. After 6 or 7 years, as the satire boom got underway, Richard found himself spreading into the new world of graduate comedy and took to trawling Cambridge each year for young comedy blades. He soon had David Frost on his books, then John Cleese and others. In the late 70s, in a wild, anarchic burst of originality, he looked westwards, and from Oxford he took on Rowan Atkinson and Howard Goodall. By 1981, he was back at Cambridge and had scooped up Emma Thompson, Hugh Laurie, Paul Shearer, Tony Slattery, and me. Now in his mid-50s, Richard found himself more and more often, he told me, looking back to the beginning of it all. This was all very interesting, and I was touched that someone usually so gruff, old-fashioned, and unforthcoming about personal matters should favour me with the true story behind his father and the founding of Noel Gay Artists. I alternately nodded and shook my head in a manner that I hoped demonstrated how sensible I was of the honour he had accorded me, and then started to make subtle, yawn-stifling gestures designed to indicate that I was ready for bath, bed, and book. "So, this brings me," said Richard, choosing to ignore these signs, "to my proposition." "Proposition?" Richard's hand scrabbled at the flaps of his old leather briefcase. "Take this." He handed me a thick foolscap typescript. Foolscap, for those under 40, was the English stationery paper size that preceded the now ubiquitous European A4 standard. I examined the sheaf. Rust marks from the binders stained the cover page, but the double underlined title was plain enough. "Oh," I said, "Me and My Girl. Is this the original script?"
As a matter of fact, said Richard, it is the copy that came back from the Lord Chamberlain. There is a French's acting edition, but what you are holding is, as far as I'm aware, the version closest to the original text, as performed in the Victoria Palace, that there is in existence. I'd like you to read it, and then I would like you to consider rewriting it. I tottered upstairs and read the foolscap typescript in bed that night. It was almost impossible to understand. The hero was a Cockney costermonger called Bill Snibson, who turns out to be the rightful heir to an earldom. That I could make out. Bill arrives at Hereford Hall, the ancestral home, to take up his position, and in a series of mysterious scenes is alternately seduced by an aristocratic vamp, taught his family history, and soaked for loans by his wastrel connections. Throughout it all runs the thread of his attempts not to lose Sally, his girl of the title. She is an honest Cockney with a noble heart, as, au fond, is he. I describe it as almost impossible to understand, and I call the scenes mysterious because of the incomprehensible buzz that was appended to almost every line of liberally exclamation-marked dialogue. Bill, what you talking about, girl? Buzz. Sally. Bill, you know very well. Buzz. Bill. You come here. Buzz. Or Sir John, taking book. Here, give me that. Buzz. Bill. Oi! Bus! And so on. Every now and then, throughout the script, there were blue pencil marks in a strong hand that read, No! Absolutely not! Rewrite! Wholly unacceptable! And other furious expressions of crazed disapprobation. At breakfast the next morning, Richard was keen to know my opinion. Well, I said, it's quite a period piece. Exactly! Which is why it needs to be updated for an 80s audience. Cockney rhyming slang stuff seems a bit old hat. There had been a scene of several pages in which Bill laboriously took the family through the principles of rhyming slang. Ah, but you see, it was me and my girl that first introduced the British theatre-going middle classes to rhyming slang, said Richard. Up until then, it had never strayed beyond the East End. Ah, right, I see. But tell me, did the original producer really hate the script? What do you mean? All those comments, unacceptable, cut this and so on, what were they about? I told you, said Richard, this was the Lord Chamberlain's copy. My blank expression revealed the unpardonable depths of my ignorance. Until 1968, all plays performed in London had to be licensed by the Lord Chamberlain. Oh, so he was the censor, effectively. The copy you have shows the cuts he, or rather his office, insisted upon in order to grant me and my girl its license in 1937. You will notice they blue pencil words like sissy. Literally blue pencil. Quite so. But what did you make of the script otherwise? Gosh, it's tremendous, but, well, I have to say I don't quite understand what the bus is doing there. The bus? I thought perhaps it was like the old word for to kiss, you know, to bus. But they can't keep kissing each other all the time, and besides, there's often a bus in scenes between two male characters. Richard looked very puzzled for a moment, and then a smile spread across his face. Ha! His laugh always started with a whip crack, ha! And then finished with a noise between his teeth that was halfway between the American sheesh and an attenuated falsetto sith. I had passed the typescript over to Lorraine Hamilton, and I now stabbed my finger down at a bus. There, I said, do you understand it? Well, said Lorraine, I'm not quite sure. It does seem rather odd. Perhaps... no, I can't think. Richard looked from one to the other of us with mounting amusement. Business, you imbeciles! Sorry? Bus is short for business. I'm not sure that we looked any the wiser. Bill was played by Lupino Lane. Lupino Lane was from a music hall dynasty. He was the finest physical comedian of his day. A huge part of his success came from the remarkable knockabout routines he devised. His business with the cloak in Me and My Girl became one of the most famous sights on the London stage. Well, I shan't take you through every twist and turn of the story of how Noel Gay's musical came to be reworked for the 1980s.
Richard, who acted as producer, secured Mike Ockrent to direct, and as a co-producer he brought in David Orkin, who ran the Theatre Royal Leicester, where the show was to be mounted. If it was a success there, the plan was to bring it into the West End. There was talk of Robert Lindsay for the lead role of Bill and Leslie Ash for Sally. Meanwhile, it was up to me to rewrite the script from that Lord Chamberlain's copy. "By the way," Richard had said, "do feel free to add any of my father's other songs that you think might fit." The script of a musical is divided into three departments: music, lyrics, and book. The book might be considered anything that isn't music or lyrics, the dialogue and story, in other words. Nobody goes to a musical because of the book. They go to straight plays for that. On the other hand, the book is the spine of a musical. Like a spine, it is only noticed when it goes wrong, and like a spine, the book supports the entire frame and transmits the signals, messages, and impulses that allow the body to feel, move, and express itself. The great composers, Sondheim, Rogers, Porter, and the rest, always insisted, indeed such insistence is one of the clichés of musical theatre, that everything starts with the book. The audience does not sing the book, nobody gasps and claps and delights in the book, but without it there is nothing. That is certainly not a complaint, by the way. There are plenty of essential jobs in the world of which people take little notice, and writing the book of the musical is amongst the least arduous and best rewarded of all of them. In 1983, I didn't know a book from a ball change or a torch song. In fact, I knew nothing about musicals at all. I was in my mid-twenties, just a year and a half out of university. I could talk nonsense all day about Shakespeare, Ibsen, Beckett or Tennessee Williams as required. I was sound on the history and heroes of radio and television comedy, which was, after all, despite the dismal public reception to Alfresco, my profession. I had a good knowledge of cinema, especially Warner Brothers films of the 30s and 40s, and British cinema of the 40s and 50s. My knowledge of the classical musical and opera repertoire was fair, and I knew the songbooks of Porter, Kern and Gershwin very well, but few of the musicals for which most of those songs were written had I ever seen. The secret truth was that I rather looked down on the whole genre. I made exceptions for Cabaret, My Fair Lady, West Side Story and Guys and Dolls, which I knew as films and records and rated highly. Singing in the Rain, Mary Poppins, Oliver and the Sound of Music I knew and valued only as films. And, well, that was about it, give or take the occasional Sunday afternoon screening of a Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly classic on BBC Two. Cats had been running in the West End for a year and a half, but I hadn't seen it. Still haven't. Must get round to it. Ditto Les Miserables, Phantom of the Opera and Miss Saigon, and all the others that have come and gone and come back again since. I don't doubt that the loss is mine. The director Mike Ockrent, who had made his name with the presentation of new theatre writing, mostly in the fringe venues of England and Scotland, knew the world of musicals even less well than I did. But we soon discovered, as we worked on the script of Me and My Girl, that we had here a project that owed nothing to Broadway and Hollywood and everything to music hall. Whether the revival succeeded or failed would depend on how ready a modern audience might be for the slapstick, silliness and cheeky bounce that the late music hall style embodied. As I went from draft to draft, David Orkin provided me with an invaluable lesson. For many years he had presided over the Hampstead Theatre, where he had nurtured Mike Lee's legendary Abigail's Party, as well as new plays by Dennis Potter, Michael Frayn, Harold Pinter, and many others. When he saw my first draft, fresh from the Daisy Wheel printer, he smiled. "Your job is to try and do yourself out of a job. The shorter the distance between musical numbers, the better." "There's just too much dialogue, isn't there?" I said. "Far too much." In the end, I cut and cut and cut. I read, on somebody's recommendation, The Street Where I Live, Alan J. Lerner's superb memoir of a Broadway lyricist and book writer's life and work. When it is time for an emotional or narrative transformation in the action of a musical, Lerner maintained, that moment should be expressed not in spoken words, but in song or in dance. Otherwise, why are you creating a musical show in the first place, and not a play? In a good musical, the action doesn't stop for a song. The songs are the action. I read this manifestly sound prescription, looked at my script thus far, and realised that I had written nothing but a stop-start drama in which everything important happened in scenes of spoken dialogue that were from time to time halted for song and dance numbers. Douglas Ferber and Arthur Rose, who had written the original book and lyrics, came from an era that preceded the Lerner Manifesto. The stagecraft of the time allowed for chorus lines to shuffle on in front of a front cloth while the scene was shifted behind. Modern theatre demanded visible changes that used trucking and flying and floating and other magical machine-driven techniques. Here, Mike Ockrent was fantastically encouraging. He had read physics at university, briefly been an inventor, and had a fine engineering mind. "Write the most extravagant and outrageous scene changes you can think of," he said. "We'll make them work. But don't write to save money. Between us, the production designer and I will make it happen." For the next draft, then, I went crazy. The show opened with a number called A Weekend at Hereford. I tweaked the lyrics a little and wrote stage directions that were, on the face of it, absurd. I described country house weekenders singing the song in open, chauffeur-driven cars as they made their way out of London, into the countryside, through the gates of Hereford Hall, and up to the massive frontage which would revolve and transform into an interior which the guests would enter to be greeted by the household servants. It was easy enough for me to write. Let Martin Johns, the designer, and Mike Ockrent make of that what they would. I cut dialogue as drastically as I could. The idea was to jump, as David Orkin had suggested, from musical number to musical number with as little dialogue as possible, but also to treat certain comic scenes, like the Lupino Lane cloak business to which Richard had alluded, as well as a seduction scene involving cushions and a sofa, as kinds of numbers in their own right. I also added two other well-known Noel Gay songs, The Sun Has Got His Hat On and Leaning on a Lamppost. Mike visited me in Chichester to work through his notes on this draft. He relished every over-ambitious, absurd and impossible demand I had made on his ingenuity. "More," he said, "let's go even further." But why, you will be wanting to know, was I in Chichester? Chichester 1. Early in 1982, Richard Armitage took me and Hugh to L'Escargot in Greek Street for lunch. "So that I get an idea of how best to shape your destinies," he said, "each of you should now tell me whose careers you most admire and whom you would most want to emulate." Hugh wondered if there was someone between Peter Ustinov and Clint Eastwood, maybe with a hint of Mick Jagger thrown in. Richard nodded, made a note in his black leather Smytheson notebook, and turned to me. "Alan Bennett," I said. "Definitely Alan Bennett." I was too young to have seen Bennett's television comedy On the Margin, the tapes of which the BBC had shamefully wiped within weeks of transmission, as was the practice in those days, but I had an audio recording of highlights which I knew off by heart, as I did the sermon in Beyond the Fringe and his cottaging sketch from The Secret Policeman's Other Ball. I had read but never seen his play Habeas Corpus and had once owned, then subsequently lost, a cassette tape of 40 Years On, in which he played a schoolmaster called Tempest. Those were enough for me to think him a hero. Talking Heads, A Private Function, An Englishman Abroad, The Madness of George III and The History Boys all lay many years in the future. "Alan Bennett, eh?" Was it paranoia, or did I sense that Richard found my answer disappointing? Peter Cook and John Cleese were greater comedy stars, with their almost rock and roll status and charisma, but Alan Bennett's miniaturism, his frailty, combined with his verbal touch and literary, almost academic frames of reference, appealed to me more as a role model. History has, of course, shown that his kind of career path was as unattainable for me as Cook's and Cleese's, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp or what's a heaven for. A year after this lunch, round about the time Gossip was getting into financial trouble and I was working on the first drafts of Me and My Girl in between sweaty bouts of not coming up with Alfresco 2 material with Hugh, Richard called me up. "Ha!" he said. "You're going to like this. Be at the Garrick Theatre on Thursday afternoon at 3:30 to audition for Patrick Garland and John Gale. Prepare the part of Tempest in 40 Years On. It's for the Chichester Festival next April. Good luck." Alan Bennett's very own part, and to be directed by the same man who directed the original production in 1960, whenever it was. I leapt for the bookshelf. I knew I had a copy somewhere, but it must have been in a box in my parents' house in Norfolk. or in that indeterminate place where lost teenage property goes, all those favourite records, wall posters and pullovers that you never see again. I streaked over to John Sandoz, where the assistant was quite sure they had a copy, if only he could lay his hands on it. Now just let him think. I almost screamed with impatience as he hunted with maddening deliberation and cheerfulness. Here we are, our only copy, a little grubby, I'm afraid. You can have it for a pound. I spent the next few hours reacquainting myself with this, Alan Bennett's first full-length dramatic work. 40 Years On is set in a fictional school called Albion House, which is mounting its annual school play, this year a specially devised pageant performed by staff and boys called Speak for England, Arthur. This play within a play takes a family through the world wars by way of a dazzling series of sketches, monologues and parodies that manage to combine, in that uniquely Bennett way, the joyously comic with the mournfully elegiac. The original production, which starred John Gielgud as the headmaster, Paul Eddington as the senior master, and Alan Bennett as the drippy junior master Tempest, was a huge success from the very beginning. The school's name, Albion House, alerted the audience to the possibility, never overstretched, that it might perhaps stand as a symbol of England itself. I learned off by heart Tempest's confirmation class, in which he attempts to give a lesson on the facts of life.
"Those are called your private parts, Foster, and if anyone ever touches them, you are to say, 'Those are my private parts, and you are not to touch them.'
"'Those are my private parts, and you are not to touch them.'
"'It doesn't apply to me, Foster. It doesn't apply to me.'
I also committed to memory a monologue in which Tempest plays a rather precious and faded literary figure recalling the great days of Bloomsbury. With these and other scenes safely in my head, I made my way by bus and tube to the Garrick Theatre in the Charing Cross Road. I found the stage door, where I was greeted by a friendly young man who led me backstage to a little green room. "My name's Michael," he said. "You're a little early, so perhaps you wouldn't mind waiting here while we just see some other people." I looked at my watch and saw that it was 2:50. Perhaps the appropriateness of the number of minutes early I was could be read as a good omen. 40 minutes on, I walked nervously onto the stage, a hand shading my eyes as I strained to see down into the auditorium. "Hello," said a neat, friendly and delicately precise voice. "I am Patrick, and this is John Gale, who runs the Chichester Festival Theatre."
"Hello,"
boomed a rich baritone from the dark. "And this," continued Patrick, "is Alan Bennett." The high tenor song of a cheery and attenuated Yorkshire, "Hello," floated up from the stalls and into my unbelieving ears. Alan Bennett, here, at the audition. Every organ in my body screamed. A hammering came into my ears and my knees turned to water. Alan Bennett. I remember not one minute or second of the half hour that followed. I know I must have recited or read some scenes, and I do recall stumbling through the London streets in an agony of despair and disappointment, so I must have said goodbye and left the theatre in some manner or other. Richard Armitage called me up at the flat that evening.
"How did it go, my dear?"
"Oh, Richard, it was awful. I was terrible, appalling, monstrous, unspeakable. Alan Bennett was there, in the theatre."
"I don't doubt it. Is that a bad thing?"
"Well, it never occurred to me he'd be present. Never. I was tongue-tied, struck dumb, so nervous I could barely speak. Oh, God, I was dreadful."
"I'm sure you can't have been as bad as all that."
He made the series of soothing and clucking noises that agents make to calm.